I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Martha, performed during the festivities of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural. He was a big fan of opera, and we're going to learn a lot about him during the course of this hour and give you, our listeners, a chance to talk about our 16th president. You know that every Lincoln's birthday, I do shows on Abraham Lincoln, 16th president of the United States, arguably the nation's best president ever. We'll talk this hour about his life. We'll talk about his writing. We'll talk about his mission and his legacy. And we'll have two guests with us. His actual birthday was Sunday, and he was 208 years old in our memory. We'll have two guests with us, both joining us from Springfield, Illinois, where he is laid to rest, where his presidential museum is, and where he is buried, where he bought his first and only house in Springfield. Abraham Lincoln is just about everywhere you look. His law office is there. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Alan Lowe is joining us first. Last summer, he was appointed director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. He had been director of the George W. Bush Presidential Library. The museum opened in 2005. It is administered by the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. And Lowe began working with the National Archives in 1989 as somebody doing archive work at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California, later acting director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library in New York. He has worked in the Office of Presidential Libraries. Our phone number, as we celebrate Abraham Lincoln this hour, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Alan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. I love Springfield, Illinois. I love Abraham Lincoln, and you probably have a job that I would enjoy having.
I feel like I've reached a real pinnacle. As you know, I've been in the world of presidential libraries and museums for most of my professional career. I took 6 years and worked with Senator Howard Baker in Tennessee, but every other position I've had in my professional career has been associated with a presidential museum in some way, and I feel like this is really the pinnacle of that. I've been very fortunate to be here since last July. It's a great, great place.
Isn't it a great place? And the whole town, I mean, Springfield was so important to Abraham Lincoln, and Abraham Lincoln is so important to Springfield. The two are just intertwined in a very deep way, I think.
I feel like he's here every day. When I started this job, people said, is it different? Most recently, I've been director of the George W. Bush Library and Museum, and they said, you know, President Bush and Mrs. Bush are there quite often, and isn't it different being here where you don't have that daily presence? And I said, I really do in many ways have that presence. Lincoln is here in Springfield, and you can walk around, you can feel his presence, his home, the old state capitol, his law office, and, of course, the library and museum. So he very much is part of the life of Springfield still to this day.
Yeah. Is the museum doing all right? I know we were there. We took a group of listeners a couple of years ago, and then years ago before that as well. There were some financial problems, I know, going on. Are those straightened out so you will survive and thrive and grow?
I absolutely have faith we will survive and thrive and grow, and we have great plans for the future. We have a lot of visitors coming in. So we're doing great business, and we want everyone to come visit us, of course, and have some wonderful exhibits. And our research component continues. We have amazing collections, not just of Lincoln materials, which we have great stuff, but also a whole range of collections related to Illinois history. We're the old State Historical Library as well. So just, I think, 5 or 6 miles worth of shelving full of these great collections. So, yes, we're absolutely thriving. He has some wonderful plans for the future.
Mm-hmm. Do you rank him? There are always those lists that historians put together of our 10 best presidents. Many historians put him at number one. Would you as well?
Oh, I would put Lincoln number one. I was just up at Mount Vernon. They were talking about some good partnerships with Mount Vernon. I think they would disagree with me, but I think Lincoln absolutely is number one for so many reasons. You look at what the man went through, preserving our union, obviously, but also giving us a freer America. And, you know, he always looked back to the Declaration of Independence and being able to get our nation closer to those ideas and ideals of the founding. That's what Lincoln gave us. And we live in a country that he helped really create. So I put him number one on the list. I know Washington is amazing. I think he's very close number two.
Mm-hmm.
And then really, there's I think there's no one else close to that. We've had some great leaders, but no one else close to those two in terms of the impact they've had on this nation.
Mm-hmm. We just did a show last week on Frederick Douglass, and what came to our attention was Frederick Douglass's criticism of Abraham Lincoln early in the war, calling him preeminently the white man's president, entirely devoted to the welfare of white men. After the war, he talked about his greatest mission was to accomplish two things. First, to save his country from dismemberment and ruin, and second, to free his country from the great crime of slavery. He goes on to talk about, we have seldom sent any man into the world better fitted for his mission than Abraham Lincoln. A man who, it would appear to me from what he said about slavery and kept saying about slavery all the time, sort of grew into what the legislation would be that would end this institution in the country. It was always there, but maybe he was slow because of political reasons to enact major legislation, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I'm still I call it my learning phase here. Still, I've always read about Lincoln and been his number one fan. But being director since July, I'm surrounded by people here and know a lot of great things. Our state historian, our Lincoln curator, I'm learning a lot. But I do agree that I think always Lincoln hated slavery. He thought it was just fundamentally a wrong thing. But to him, as a leader, the question was, how then do you stop its spread? And how eventually do you eliminate it? You see throughout his life him struggling with that, you know, the whole support early on of colonization in Africa, like his idol Henry Clay had proposed, of how do you address this fundamental wrong that is so counter to what we're supposed to be about as a free republic. You also see, I think this is something we can't ever put to the side, the requirements of leading during the time of war and what he had to balance.
Yes.
And, you know, being able to preserve the Union first and foremost, because without that, then nothing is there. And how do you keep the border states loyal or, you know, not seceding? That was obviously very important to him and the success of the war effort. And then also you have to realize Lincoln was a lawyer, and he took very seriously his duties under the Constitution. And he wanted to see how a path forward in terms of the Constitution we could move forward and eliminate the scourge of slavery rather than just by fiat. So that's you have to balance all those things, but realizing fundamentally the man hated slavery, and the question is, how do you stop its spread and eventually eliminate it?
Mm-hmm. He's also been described as a consummate politician.
Oh, yes, and that's something I think sometimes we put him on a pedestal rightly. But we also forget this was a man who was a very good politician and willing to fight the political fights he needed to throughout his career, you know, in the state legislature and moving up the rungs there. He was very, very formidable and very, very good politician.
Mm-hmm. We introduced this show a little while ago by talking about something that Gary Wills had said about him, which is really pretty striking, and you can just take this in and have to think about it for a while. He had to impel his followers to attack other Americans with the aim eventually of winning them back to the Union after having crushed them.
Yeah.
What a mission. What a task.
It really is, and you think about, you know, we've talked a lot here about leadership and decision making. And when he goes into office, there's no honeymoon. I mean, immediately he faces the issue of what to do about Fort Sumter.
You know, right.
As he goes, and states are already seceding, obviously, as he's inaugurated. So, you know, the fundamental decision, what do you ask your fellow Americans to then make war to preserve the Union, or what do you do? Or do you say, well, they want out, then they're out. You know. So what do you do as you face that? And for him, it was fundamental. He took an oath, uphold the Constitution, and that meant, you know, you preserve the Union. And that's what he did. But, yes, being able to do that and to do it successfully, though, you know, early on with all the defeats and the criticisms that came his way, it was a real close thing. So that's something we forget also of how much opposition there was to the war effort, to the execution of the war effort, to the Emancipation Proclamation. We have a great part of our museum here where you go through and you hear all this audio and different faces appearing beside you screaming out why they're for or against emancipation and all the different voices coming his way. And here was a man at the end of the day who stayed true to his principles, who showed amazing strength and determination and persistence, and thank God for that.
Mm-hmm. and who evidently really thought in his heart of hearts that he didn't stand one chance of being reelected. He thought he was not going to be, and the racist rhetoric of that campaign was quite something.
That's exactly right, and only, I think, a couple of really good victories in the field, I think Atlanta and so forth, have really helped seal the deal on that. But, yeah, that, again, a very close thing, and God knows what would have happened if he had lost that election.
Right. He has said, when asked about his early life, and I'm really struck by his early life as well, because this guy had nothing. I mean, he had absolutely nothing. "It's a great piece of folly," Lincoln said, "to attempt to make anything out of my early life. It can all be condensed into a simple sentence, and that sentence you'll find in Gray's Elegy, the short and simple Annals of the Poor. That's my life, and that's all you or anyone else can make out of it."
Yes, and you look, if you go back in a time machine, you see a young Lincoln. I don't know if you say, well, that's the not just a future president, but the greatest president in our history standing there before you, growing up very poor, moving, you know, essentially on the frontier, trying to make his way in this world, and it was not an easy thing. And eventually you see him when the family moves from Kentucky, where, by the way, I was born, so one of my earliest memories is going to his birthplace, yes, and early on getting that love of history and the love of Lincoln, and then, of course, going to Indiana and eventually coming to Illinois. And the really fascinating thing about him, when he moves to Illinois, and then he takes out on his own to New Salem here in Illinois in 1831, not, you know, much to his name at that point, just this young kid going out there. And, you know, just a couple years later, he is, that's 1834, he's in the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so very quickly, showing that ability, that intelligence, that ambition that we also sometimes don't ascribe to him, a great ambition to do better things with his life. So starting from those difficult beginnings, making not just something of himself, but a legend of himself.
Mm. Have you been to New Salem yet, Ellen?
I have, yes, absolutely. I made sure I went up there right away. And, you know, a great place. That's one of the many great things about the Springfield area is you have all those area, different Lincoln sites around here. You can go to New Salem, Old State Capitol, go out, of course, to the Lincoln Tomb, and really and the Lincoln Home, and really experience Lincoln fully.
Mm-hmm. And it's an unusual library, isn't it, in that it's not a part of some of the other presidential libraries are. Or what, tapped into the archives, or what's the story on that?
Yeah, there are now, with the Obama Library, there will be 14 presidential libraries and museums that are part of the National Archives, which is a federal agency, and that's where I worked for most of my career. But the Lincoln Library is not. It's part of the state of Illinois. As you said, we're part of the Historic Preservation Agency, so we are a bit different in that regard. We do have a private foundation that supports us as well, does fundraising, and helps us out in a multitude of ways. But yeah, we are a slightly different model in that regard.
We welcome phone calls. We're celebrating Abraham Lincoln's birthday. He would have been 208 years old on Sunday, and we're looking at the legacy of Abraham Lincoln because he was a great president, and we do this almost every year. I've been doing this almost every year for a long time. Our phone number for you to join the conversation and talk about the legacy of this incredible president is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. The second half hour of the program, we'll be speaking with someone who spoke to a group of listeners that we accompanied to Springfield just about a year and a half ago, and I did another trip there some years ago. We'll be speaking with Samuel Wheeler, who is now the 10th state historian of Illinois. He did his PhD work on the Civil War and on Abraham Lincoln, and pays particular attention to the poetry of Abraham Lincoln, not only that which he read, but that which he wrote. And we'll talk about the phenomenal importance of his words. I've heard more than one historian discuss the fact that he was probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, writer of the 19th century. To you momentarily, and we'll start taking calls after this here on the Ideas Network. A Lincoln Tribute show this hour. Alan Lowe, our first guest, executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. Paul on Facebook writes this: Alan, one of my greatest thrills was standing so close to the president while at his tomb in Springfield. I could not help imagining all that he endured and all that he did. And that sense of all he endured and all he did is everywhere in Springfield, and it's everywhere when you read and think a lot about this president, isn't it?
See those, most famously, of course, in the portraits, the photos of him through his time in the office. You see a fairly young-looking man that first year, and by the last photo before his assassination, and he looks like he's aged 20 or 30 years. The intense pressure he was under, the multitude of voices yelling at him from every direction. The number of defeats at the beginning of the war, not even knowing if they could hold Washington, D.C., the uncertainty of it, the death of his son while in the White House.
Yes.
You know, all those problems this man faced, but to hold up under it and not break is amazing. And yes, you know, I immediately made the pilgrimage to the tomb and standing there before him. It is kind of an overwhelming experience to know that just a few feet away there is the man who is responsible for saving this country in so many ways.
Let's go to some phone calls. Margaret in Madison. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I wonder if you could comment on Lincoln's struggles with what he deemed melancholia, which I'm sure we would say is depression now. And he seemed to write about it honestly. And I wondered if he ever found any relief in any herbs or any medicines, or was it just something that he had to overcome on a daily basis to survive and keep the country together? Any comments on that?
Sure. And I said earlier, I'm kind of on a learning tour here, and that's something I'm learning more about. I've read about that over the years as well, and it certainly, most definitely, was a feature of his life. And you see it sometimes being almost, it was at times debilitating to him, where he simply didn't leave the room for a while. And you see that at different points of his life. So this is a man who definitely dealt with whatever we may call it. And in terms of remedies, I'm not sure. And Sam Wheeler, who works for us here as a state historian, is amazingly knowledgeable. He's coming up next.
Yes.
He will. He can tell you more on that. But I can tell you one thing that Lincoln always would do was retreat to work. This was a man who worked amazingly hard. So he took strength from that. He also took strength from humor, in a way. And this is something you hear a lot about with him, almost gallows humor sometimes, of telling these long, very humorous stories, and that's rather laugh than cry, I guess, might be part of that. So I think that's part of that equation, but definitely something he dealt with. And again, to know that background and then to see the intense stress and sorrow, you know, in the Civil War, the first casualty was his good friend. Another casualty was Edward Baker, who he named his first son after. So, you know, it was immediately. And then, of course, every soldier that died, he knew, was under his orders, right? So he made the decision, and this was happening under his watch. So to have that stress anyway for anyone, but especially for someone who suffered already from that type of melancholy or depression, was just amazing to think that he held up under it.
Thank you, Margaret, for your call. Michael in Sun Prairie. Hi, Michael.
Well, hello. How are you?
Fine, Michael. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to comment and make a few comments. You know, one of the things in Lincoln's early life, you have to think about this. He had a wonderful set of skills matched to what he was doing. You know, he was immigrating from the western Appalachians up into Indiana and then eventually to Illinois. And you make your living in large part, and he did, as an agricultural worker. Hoeing, you know, husbandry, log splitting, all those kind of skills he had. He was a remarkably strong, physically capable person. So I think it's important that people keep that in mind, that the set of skills he had, in addition to this extraordinary intellect, was his great physical capabilities as well.
Yeah.
I think that's right, yes. And, you know, he always was a very tall man, and I think took pride, frankly, in his physical strength. He could out-wrestle anyone. So that definitely was part of his makeup and part of his persona.
6'4". That's really tall at that time. He must have towered over almost everyone.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Certainly would tower over me.
Yeah. And let's go to Tim in Waukesha next. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi, Tim.
Hi. I just want to talk about the most famous thing he ever did that people don't know about, and it's called a land patent. And that gave the people in the United States the right to own property for the rest of their life and their heirs or assigns. And that's what we need to get away from the banking cartels that we have today. But he was very instrumental in that. You have Kennedy, and also one of the greatest guys we ever had was Andrew Jackson. And he got rid of the central bank as we know it, and they got back in when Lincoln was there. But Lincoln was instrumental in giving us tremendous freedom.
Thanks very much for your call. He was a man of many talents. When you think about somebody talked about his agriculture skills, he also ran a store in New Salem. Didn't do it very well, actually.
That's right.
But he just sort of, and the other, and I say this all the time about him, but to learn all of that and to learn Shakespeare the way he did and poetry the way he did and the Bible the way he did, which of course informed the beautiful way in which he wrote, all self-taught.
Also a surveyor as well, postmaster, and a big fan of Shakespeare. I've been reading on that connection and his love, particularly of Macbeth and Hamlet, and it really did contribute to his writing and his ability to talk to us as a people about the weighty issues of the day in an amazingly poetic way. And yes, I mean, speaking about his domestic agenda, that's something as we look at his legacy that obviously we focus on the Emancipation Proclamation, the preservation of the Union, but doing things like the Homestead Act and, setting up land-grant institutions. The National Academy of Sciences started during his presidency. So just an amazing number of things. And you look back again, this is a man who politically was a Whig for most of his career before the creation of the Republican Party, and he idolized Henry Clay and his American system. And so many of those things, that kind of infrastructure-type things for building up a nation, Lincoln was able to accomplish during his presidency. They don't get as much kind of press nowadays, but were hugely important to the development of modern America.
Well, Alan, enjoy immensely all your time in Springfield. I would imagine you just won't ever want to leave. You're at the pinnacle
That's
of
right.
presidential libraries,
That's
so why
right.
go
you
anywhere
You cannot
else?
Beat Abraham Lincoln, right? That's right.
So have a wonderful time. Thank you so much for being with
hope
us.
You all come visit us here.
Yeah, we have. I've taken listeners there twice, and I hope to do it once again at least. Alan Lowe, Executive Director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. If you haven't been to Springfield, and if you have a deep interest in Abraham Lincoln, it is the place to go. Well, we're very delighted to have now with us, as we talk about Abraham Lincoln's words, particularly Samuel Wheeler. Professor Wheeler was last summer named Illinois State Historian. He's the 10th historian of the state of Illinois, oversees research and collections at the State Historical Library, which was created in 1889 and is now part of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Prior to this, he was the research historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. He has worked for many years in the field of public history, and he has a unique perspective on all of this because he is a Springfield native, so he knows this town very, very well. He received his PhD at Southern Illinois University, specializing in the Civil War era, the life and legacy of Abraham Lincoln, and was an award-winning instructor in the classroom, and we had the great pleasure of listening to him speak on a fairly recent listener journey to Springfield. He talked about Lincoln Springfield, why Springfield was important to Lincoln, and why Lincoln is important to Springfield. Samuel Wheeler, nice to talk to you again, sir. Hi.
It is wonderful to talk to you again. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you. And you have a new position since we last heard you speak.
Oh, my gosh. I've been very busy. Being the state historian of Illinois is fantastic. But, it keeps me really busy. Inherent in the position come some administrative tasks as well as, some more practical historical matters. I'm the historian of record for all 56 historic sites in the state of Illinois.
Oh, my.
But also, I help run the historical library here, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, oversee these collections as well as the staff that helps researchers from all over the world unlock the Lincoln legacy and all sorts of matters related to Illinois history.
Mm. Well, you're the right guy for the job, that's for sure. We had the great pleasure of listening to you speak. And also, you're from Springfield, and it's sort of in your blood, huh? It's in your bones.
Boy, I tell you what, Kathleen, a lot of people say that. Yeah, I'm from Springfield originally, but, you know, life is weird. I had to go away to school to really gain a proper perspective on who Lincoln was and his significance in world history. It's sort of a strange thing. You grow up so close to it, perhaps you take it for granted a little bit. And it wasn't until I went to university and I took a course on the Civil War, and I, for the first time, really spent some time with those horrific photographs of the Civil War, particularly in the aftermath of Antietam.
Mm-hmm.
And I became completely mesmerized by the Civil War and my reading about America's biggest tragedy, really, drew me into learning more about this figure, Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, I grew up in Lincoln's shadow here in Springfield. So that was a really interesting perspective.
Hmm. Well, it's Valentine's Day. So who did Abraham Lincoln love?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Mary Todd Lincoln was Abraham Lincoln's Valentine for a better part of his life. There was a deep love there. Mary Lincoln, I think, is an incredibly interesting individual. And in here at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum, we talk a little bit about Mary. I think we're going to talk more about her in the future because she was such a complex figure, but also, you know, we're learning more and more about her, and I think as time goes on, we're perhaps more sympathetic to a little bit of some of the things that she went through. But Abraham Lincoln loved her dearly. There was a deep mutual love there.
Hmm. And he cared for her, too. There's a tenderness about him in his relationship with his wife, who had significant problems of her own. But there was a tenderness, probably an exasperation as well. But he was also good to her.
There are very few letters that exist between Abraham and his wife, Mary. We are fortunate enough to own a couple of them here. And if you read those letters, they come from the 1840s when they're separated. Lincoln is in Congress, and Mary is has the boys, and she's living back at her father's home. And those couple letters that are exchanged between the couple are very loving. There is a deep love there, and the love that they had in common was for their boys. They loved those children very, very deeply. They were in lockstep on the way they wanted to raise their boys, which was quite uncommon in the 19th century in the sense that they let their boys run wild. those boys, the folks that knew the Lincolns, they all gossiped about how those boys were not under lock and chain from their parents, certainly. And I always point to that. Mary and Abraham, they come from two different worlds, certainly, but we know that in some cases opposites attract, right? But I think when we delve deeper into their backgrounds, they shared so much in common. And one of the very unfortunate things that Abraham Lincoln and his wife shared in common were unhappy childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Though they came from different ends of the economic spectrum and the social ladder, they certainly did not have the fortune of having a really happy childhood, and they were determined to give their sons a much different start in life.
I was reading an essay in Life magazine, of all places, 1991 or 92 this morning, about Abraham Lincoln, written by Gary Wills. And I'd like for you to respond to this, because I know that you did a dissertation on Abraham Lincoln's poetry, and I know he read a lot of poetry, and certainly William Herndon had a huge collection of poetry. Wills writes, Abraham Lincoln is our only chief executive who became a great president because he was a great writer. He had other great qualities, but these reached many of his contemporaries and most of us born later because of his mastery over words. He is so much the greatest of our political rhetoricians that even temperate historians tend, if anything, to overstate the importance of his verbal powers. He had them and then some, didn't he?
You better believe it. We were able to carry on quite a conversation with Abraham Lincoln today because of the wonderful words he left behind. Some of us have been to Washington, D.C. Washington Monument always strikes me as a beautiful piece. I remember, you know, folks in the 19th century looked at that same monument that I'm looking at. George Washington certainly left a huge mark in America in founding the nation. The Lincoln Memorial is not too far away. And what's interesting about the Lincoln Memorial versus the Washington Monument, Lincoln's words flank him in that Lincoln Memorial. The words of the Gettysburg Address, as well as those eloquent words of the second inaugural. If we recover the context, Abraham Lincoln was president during the American Civil War, the darkest days that we've ever faced as a nation, where our mere existence as a united nation was in question. Abraham Lincoln had to use his words to steady the nation during those dark days, to let them know that the sacrifice was worth it, that it wasn't just a struggle that folks in the 1860s were engaged in, but this was a struggle for all time in the terms of the fate of the nation. Those words, most eloquently at Gettysburg, again, the second inaugural, but there's so many other examples of it. I think in large part, and this is not new to me, historians have pointed this out, but Abraham Lincoln won the war with words.
Yeah, I think he was morally persuasive and certainly had to be. Well, I'm glad you mentioned both of those speeches. We're going to listen to all of the Gettysburg Address, and then we'll hear a little bit of the second inaugural, also a brilliant piece of writing at Gettysburg, and we'll have our historian analyze this. What's amazing is that he was an afterthought. If you don't know the story, Edward Everett was the main event at Gettysburg. He was a former president of Harvard, a German-trained scholar, and he asked to have the commemoration of the cemetery put off a little bit so he could prepare his remarks, which lasted for 2 hours and very much pleased the crowd. And then, of course, Lincoln gave the few remarks that he was scheduled to make. They were over, well, this one's 1 minute and 45 seconds. The reaction was respectful, but everybody was wondering, well, what was that all about? But Everett realized what had happened, and he wrote Lincoln right after saying, I should be glad to flatter myself that I came as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. Here's the Gettysburg Address.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of it as a final resting place for those who died here, that the nation might live. This we may, in all propriety, do. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have hallowed it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, while it can never forget what they did here. It is rather for us, the living. We here be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here, high highly resolve these dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
The way he could take words and put those words together in a form that was not 2 hours long or even 2 minutes long to explain the enormity of an event or to persuade a nation to bind the wounds. It's just phenomenal ability that he had to use words, isn't it?
There's no question about it. That eloquence comes, first off, some of that eloquence is God-given, certainly. But a big part of that eloquence is hard work. It's trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded shortly after the word gets around of the Battle of Gettysburg and, the fall of Vicksburg, folks come to the White House, they call on Lincoln to give a speech, and he starts out that speech with the same idea that he's able to refine at Gettysburg, but on his first draft of this idea, he says, what was it, 80-some-odd years ago? And, over time, he's able to refine that language to the 47 years ago, that biblical tenor that he's able to find months later at Gettysburg. And the thing about those words that strikes me is that they still resonate with us today.
Yes, they do.
What folks often don't understand, and we're at a really unique place here at the Presidential Museum to see this occur, is that those words have relevance not just for us Americans in the 21st century, but believe me, they resonate with folks from all over the world. I've had the great experience to give tours through our museum to a Pakistani journalist, someone who had never been out of her country. And she was participating in a program, exchange program with the Chicago Tribune. And she had come here to take a tour. And she knew very little about Abraham Lincoln, but do you know she rattled off the first sentence of the Gettysburg Address to me from memory?
Oh.
That gave me absolute chills. We hosted the Secretary General from the United Nations last month here. When we were in the Gettysburg Gallery, he closed his eyes and began to recite the Gettysburg Address from memory. It's so powerful when you remember that. I've been to Gettysburg. I've been to that cemetery. And, it's an amazing experience when you recover the context and remember the gravity of the situation in which those words were spoken. And Edward Everett, the first speaker that day, he had asked Abraham Lincoln later in 1864 if he would write out that brief speech that he gave that day. And Everett compiled it in a little scrapbook. He actually wrote out his two-hour-long speech, and he pasted in the two pages that Abraham Lincoln sent him. And that notebook got auctioned off for the benefit of the soldiers. And it floated around in private hands until the middle of the 20th century. And it came back up for auction. And school kids from Illinois donated their pennies.
Aww.
And they were able to purchase that notebook. And that is in our collection today. And we have one of the five existing copies of the Gettysburg Address.
Oh, Samuel.
And this gives you an insight into Abraham Lincoln's writing process. Those five copies of the Gettysburg Address are all slightly different because each time Abraham Lincoln wrote it out, he revised. He made very small, subtle changes in his language, and the copy we have is the very first copy in which he inserted the phrase, under God, towards the end of that address.
Oh, I love these stories. Let's go to phone calls. Daniel in Upper Peninsula is calling in. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Great show. I really appreciate it. Talk about boys running wild. my sons were in Gettysburg with my wife and I in 2003, and they were like 14 and 8, and they were running across that battlefield like crazy, sort of like Lincoln's kids. I'm calling today to just talk about, we took a trip to Gettysburg in 03, and in 2012 we went to Kentucky to see where Lincoln was born, and at the little creek that his other house was at, Hodgensville or something, I think his homestead was there. But what I get from Lincoln and thinking about today's politics, I've been teaching for 32 years, he seems to have an enlightenment that modern politicians lack. Our current president almost brags about not being a reader. And no wonder the current Republicans, maybe even more so Democrats, they claim Lincoln as theirs. He's not a modern Republican. He was a new Republican back in 1856 and 1860. I'm just wondering if any of you could comment on his depth and the fact that he seemed to, in a blue-collar way, represent the people more so than modern politicians.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel, thank you so much for the question. And my God, you're an educator for more than 30 years. God bless you. As far as Abraham Lincoln, I will tell you this about Mr. Lincoln, and we tend to overlook this, and it's important that we hesitate here. Mr. Lincoln had less than a year of formal education. I find that remarkable. The education that Mr. Lincoln attained was a lifelong pursuit. He fought for that education. He knew that that education was his ticket out of the wilderness, quite literally. He had no desire to be a subsistence farmer. There was more in this world for him that he wanted to accomplish. And so if it was studying the technical points of grammar, or if it was learning mathematics, or anything along these lines, Mr. Lincoln fought very hard for that. The blue-collar aspect of Mr. Lincoln, I'm glad that you pointed that out as well. Because one of the most important aspects of Mr. Lincoln to remember is that he was a lawyer. He was a lawyer for 25 years of his life. That was how he put food on his table. And he was the type, you'll see sometimes that he was, he's billed as this, big corporation lawyer or something like that. The fact of the matter in Mr. Lincoln's legal career, he traveled an old, dusty law circuit in central Illinois. He was away from home 6 months out of the year. The majority of the 5,000 legal cases that he was engaged in those 25 years were very small cases for $5 or $10 fees. When he's arguing in front of a jury, remember who that jury's made up of, the common folks. And Abraham Lincoln definitely was a master storyteller. He could distill very complex ideas down to where he could convey those ideas to a jury made up of common folks, sometimes illiterate folks, sometimes not ignorant folks, not dumb individuals per se, but uneducated folks. Abraham Lincoln was surrounded by people like that, and he could communicate complex ideas to those folks. And I think a lot of the secret to Abraham Lincoln's mastery of his political rhetoric can be found with that 25-year experience as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Samuel Wheeler is our guest, and Samuel is, he was kind enough a year and a half ago. We took a group of listeners to Springfield, and he gave a speech that was just very nicely received. He is now, he's recently been named the Illinois State Historian, the 10th historian of the state, and he also has been working in the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library for a number of years. He did his PhD on the Civil War and on Abraham Lincoln. We're welcoming phone calls and listening a little bit to John McCormack singing Annie Laurie, which was a song that Abraham Lincoln liked on this Valentine's Day. It's an old Scottish love ballad. And we'll welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number.
If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern there any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in the living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphans, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Orson Welles reading portions of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural. Let's go back to phone calls. Lori is next in Madison. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you so much for today's show.
You're welcome.
Speaking of Lincoln's writings, it's important to note that Lincoln is the author of several documents. And although they don't have the weight of the law as written in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, nonetheless, some Supreme Court justices and constitutional scholars will consult these documents for the light that they shed on our understanding of the Constitution and what it is to be American.
Samuel.
Yeah, in terms of, the light that they shed on the legal precedents or defining the Constitution, that's certainly one way to look at it. I think, where you're heading with that thought. Abraham Lincoln, his thoughts and what he stood for, they certainly do tell us what it's like to be an American. Abraham Lincoln is the most written about American of there ever was, perhaps that there ever will be. And if politicians, even advertising agencies, love to connect their brand or their politics, et cetera, with Abraham Lincoln. He's the greatest salesman of all time in terms of those things. There's a lot you can do with that.
Thank you so much for the call. He wrote poetry. Now, you did. We didn't even get to this. I'm sorry. And it's the last part of the program. But you did a dissertation on his poems, didn't you?
I did indeed. There's the thousands of books written about Abraham Lincoln. There's never been a full-length study of the poetry that he wrote. And to me, I was so intrigued by that. This poetry that he wrote was never meant to be published under his name or anything like that. It was a writing exercise and also an exercise of sorting out his feelings on complex issues. It's not great poetry by a standard definition, but my goodness, do I think it's important in terms of understanding Abraham Lincoln, the man, a little deeper. And then I also think that there's some relevance in understanding Lincoln, the writer, by looking at his poetry as well.
Mm-hmm. He was also quite a jokester.
My goodness, was he ever. Kathleen, one of the things folks ask me, what did I think of the Spielberg movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I always say I love that movie. And what I always go back to, and, you know, maybe this is laughable or something, but my favorite part of that movie was I got to hear Abraham Lincoln tell a joke. That was
the bathroom joke.
Phenomenal. Well, you know, there's many stories and jokes in that movie, but yeah, the bathroom one
was hysterical.
Good,
wasn't it? Yes, it was.
Yeah, and it's a true story, you know. So we've been told through the recollections that came from real evidence. But that was such a fundamental part of his character. And historians like myself, who are engaged in writing articles and books, we try to work in Lincoln jokes, and more times than not, they kind of fall flat in the written form. But when I saw Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, what a wonderful portrayal that
was. It was a brilliant
performance. Telling a joke, I understood immediately why those jokes kind of fall flat in books, because we understand that telling a joke is so more than just the words.
Right. And Samuel, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope to come down and visit again sometime soon. You were great. And thanks for being gracious.
Thank you so much.
Samuel Wheeler, the 10th State Historian of Illinois and Director of Research and Collections at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks to Natalie, and thanks to Colleen, and thanks for listening.